Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This legislation will signal a change in direction in Iraq that will end the fighting and bring our troops home.
Never before in our history has Congress attempted to control or restrict battlefield decisions.
Long Island Congressman Peter King, preceded by Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi from the Iraq War floor debate last week. And with that, we begin a special President's Day edition of our weekly series, Monday Morning Politics. By the way, happy year of the rat. This President's Day, though, finds the President and Congress possibly heading toward a constitutional crisis over the management of the Iraq War. For example, the Senate may consider rescinding or modifying the October 2002 vote, that famous vote that Hillary Clinton is still trying to live down, that authorized the war. Here is Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Carl Levin on Fox News Sunday yesterday.
One thought is that we should limit the mission to a support mission. In other words, an anti-terrorist mission to go after al-Qaeda in Iraq, to support and train the Iraqi army, to protect our own diplomatic personnel and other personnel in Iraq, rather than this unlimited mission which was described in the authorization for the use of force. We think that that would be constitutional, and it also would move us towards the end of our presence in Iraq.
By the way, did I say year of the rat? It's the year of the pig. Happy year of the pig. But anyway, does the president even need the authorization that Carl Levin is talking about? Here is former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, also on Fox News Sunday.
The Marine Corps hymn starts with from the shores of from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Jefferson sent the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Navy to Tripoli, attacking Barbary pirates who had been capturing Americans without notifying Congress. Now, Jefferson had some knowledge of the Constitution and did not believe in a particularly large government. But he thought the president in foreign policy had to be able to act, not just to get involved in a debating society. This was a lesson the Founding Fathers learned fighting the Revolutionary War for 8 long years. The Continental Congress could authorize in general, but it couldn't manage the war.
Well, we will hear some more clips, including some historical ones, as we talk about the Iraq War in constitutional and historical context, and also get a little bit into the 2008 presidential race. Later, we'll speak with presidential historian Douglas Brinkley. Right now, Julian Zelizer, he is a congressional historian, a professor of history at Boston University. He has an article in the March American Prospect magazine on how Congress helped end the Vietnam War. His last book was The American Congress, The Building of Democracy, published by Houghton Mifflin in 2004. And Professor Zelizer, thanks so much for coming back on WNYC today. Good morning. Happy President's Day. And, happy Year of the Pig.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's dig right into this potential constitutional crisis. Are we on the verge of a historically unique showdown over war powers?
No, not at this point. During most battles, we've had these kind of confrontations. Certainly during Vietnam, we had a confrontation as heated as the one we are seeing now. The rhetoric usually escalates to what we are seeing. But we do have a president who is unwilling to bend in terms of executive power. So it's going to be interesting to see if there is some kind of breaking point for him in which he starts to compromise.
What did you think of some of the history lesson that Professor Gingrich was trying to give us there about Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates and the Continental Congress and the Revolutionary War?
Well, Gingrich is right and wrong. Gingrich is right in that that's not the only example you can find going throughout American history where presidents have been very assertive with their power during wartime, and they've sent troops and authorized missions with or without presidential consent. I mean, since World War II, we've had many cases where this has happened. But he's wrong in saying that there is no room in the Constitution for Congress to assert its will before a war starts or after a war is in progress. That's simply not the case. Congress has many powers, from the power of the purse to the power of investigation, which it has used and it can use to change or limit what the president is doing.
Listeners, we'll open up the phones on this President's Day on war powers between Congress and the president. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. Opinions are okay. historical analysis. Questions for Professor Zelizer and later for Douglas Brinkley are okay at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrshow@wnyc.org. Let me dig into that a little further. Part of Gingrich's point was that the president doesn't need Congress for every action. And if I remember correctly, even that 2002 Iraq War vote was not a declaration of war in the formal sense under the Constitution, but a non-binding resolution supporting an invasion that the president claimed that he could do without Congress anyway. Is that correct?
Yeah, what's true is that Congress did give the president, with the war in Iraq and the war on terrorism, authorization to use what force was necessary to accomplish the mission. And within that, the president has wiggle room while the war is in progress to make strategic decisions. But that does not preclude Congress from then reacting or changing course if they don't believe the original resolution is being carried forward or they believe mistakes are being made. It doesn't disempower Congress, even with the resolution they passed. So that's how he can be right and wrong, both Gingrich and both President Bush, even when you have authorization like this. We've seen many cases where there's this kind of authorization, where Congress then makes the decision. Again, Vietnam's a good example, that the mission is not being carried out properly or it's unwinnable, and then they can react.
And what about Senator Levin then? That clip we played of him, I'll quote from it again. He said, "One thought is that we should limit the mission to a support mission, in other words, an anti-terrorist mission to go after al-Qaeda in Iraq, to support and train the Iraqi army, to protect our own diplomatic personnel and other personnel in Iraq, and that this unlimited mission, which was described in the authorization for the use of force." In other words, he doesn't only support changing the mission in these ways, he may help hold a Senate vote that changes the 2002 authorization. How much force of law could that have?
I don't know how much it can have force of law. I mean, Ronald Reagan discovered that when Congress passes these kind of restrictions, you can get into serious legal and political problems. This was with Central America in the 1980s when Congress limits spending and the NSC tries to go around what Congress wanted.
That's the Iran-Contra scandal, right?
That becomes the Iran-Contra
scandal. The Contra part. Congress said you can't do it, and Reagan did it anyway with Oliver North.
Exactly, and he does survive politically, but he does play his presidency and his administration in legal and political jeopardy. And I think President Bush would be in a similar situation if Congress really, really limits what can go on right now and changes the original resolution or words the resolution to say our intent was not to enter into a civil war or to try to rebuild a country in the middle of a civil war. It was to knock out Saddam Hussein, and there you have a mission accomplished. And if the president then continued to push forward, I think what a political crisis we have now can turn into a constitutional crisis very easily.
Also joining us now is presidential historian Douglas Brinkley. He's with us from the airport in New Orleans. He's professor of history and director of the Roosevelt Center at Tulane University. His many books include, most recently, Gerald R. Ford, just published by Times Books, and I understand he has another one coming out in May, built around some of Ronald Reagan's diaries. So, Dr. Brinkley, so nice to have you back on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm sorry I'm calling from an airport. I've been having a flight mayhem. Almost of the JetBlue variety.
You and half the country, so we sympathize. And you're on, by the way, with Julian Zelizer. I don't know if you know each other, a congressional historian from Boston University.
Yes, I know him. I respect him greatly.
And Professor Brinkley, let me replay for you a clip of Senator Chuck Hagel on Meet the Press yesterday that we used before the news. We've been talking about what may become a constitutional crisis between the president and Congress over war powers, and this is how stark the debate is becoming over the role of the presidency.
It is time for the Congress to be part of the decision-making process. The American people want it that way. That's why you have a Congress. We're Article I of the Constitution. We tried a monarchy once. It didn't work very well.
Professor Brinkley, can you put that in historical context?
Well, the first historical context is that it's ringing, Iraq's ringing everybody's Vietnam bell. Chuck Hagel is becoming, Fulbright and McGovern were And then, you know, even eventually people like Barry Goldwater during the Vietnam era, meaning he's starting to really square off with the sitting president. He's clearly is in, you know, disagrees with Bush policy. And I do think we're going to be hearing a lot about war powers coming up. I know the Baker Institute at Rice University, where former Secretary of State James Baker is right now doing a kind of war powers study group, not dissimilar from the Iraq study group that he did, trying to understand just what is a president's war powers. It's always very confusing because the president has the ability to declare war whenever he wants to, but of course you always have to go then and get a congressional resolution later. And what's going on in Iraq right now, it's unclear because the president himself had said mission accomplished, and so we're now, by everybody's view, in the middle of a civil war. And did we really send troops to, referee a civil war? And so I think this is going to be the big buzzword, the issue of this next 6 months is does the Bush administration have unilateral war powers acts? And Congress, very well led by Democrats and Republicans like Hagel and Warner, tried to say that we're going to take over the situation in Iraq by controlling the funding. Remember, it was Congress who cut the funding to the Vietnam War, which forced Gerald Ford's hand, and Ford at my university, Tulane, eventually in April of 75, gave a speech saying, you know, we're out of Vietnam, it's over. We put it behind us. But that was only because Ford was forced to that position by a Democratic Congress.
I'm curious, as you work with the Reagan diaries, have you come across anything relating to the Contra part of Iran-Contra? Professor Zelizer had just reminded us of Congress's futile attempt to cut off funding for the Nicaraguan Contras, and then President Reagan got around it through the National Security Council.
Well, it's very similar thinking that Ronald Reagan had to what President Bush has. That is, in Reagan's view, the situation of the Monroe Doctrine being dishonored in this hemisphere, the Marxist and a communist anti-American Sandinista party in Nicaragua was getting some funding from the Soviet Union. Hence, they were dishonoring the Monroe Doctrine, and he had every justification to try to topple that government any way that he could, or to help the Contras that were fighting the Sandinistas. And Reagan tried to, the Reagan administration, and never really was able to be pinpointed to the president himself, circumvented the law. And men that were the top rungs of government, like Poindexter and Ollie North and McFarland, came crashing down due to the event. So I think the Iran-Contra lasts in history as a lesson that the Bush administration has to be careful of if they don't want to play ball with Congress and they try to circumvent it by illegal means, that the full heat of the media and the country will be on them in no time.
Let's take a phone call. Here is John in New Jersey. John, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. I have been wondering, as this debate has proceeded, why no parties have raised the applicability of the War Powers Act of 1973. Has it completely been discarded as a tool for Congress?
Now, this, of course, was a response to Vietnam and the way the U.S. got into Vietnam after the Gulf of Tonkin incident without ever a declaration of war, and what a war that became. Professor Zelizer, what about the 1973 War Powers Act?
Yeah, I mean, the 1973 Act is a historic marker about what form these constitutional battles can take. It was a remnant of the Vietnam War. It was a product of the great frustration that Congress felt with being overridden by the executive. The problem is the War Powers Act has not really been followed since it was passed, and Congress has not been tough on following the measures in most cases. And the executive has still continued to find leeway throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, and now 2000s in using force without fully following the law or spirit of the War Powers Act. That said, we haven't been in a conflict of this size and in terms of ground troops, in terms of length, in terms of cost and death since Vietnam. So that War Powers Act is one measure that Congress can draw on in trying to talk about the issues that Professor Brinkley is raising about the limitations of presidential power. There are laws on the books. There are precedents that Congress can easily turn to if it wants to really flex its muscle.
We'll continue in a minute, and among other things, we'll get into some of the historical firsts in the 2008 presidential campaign that are already emerging, and we will play a historical clip of John F. Kennedy running as the first potential Catholic president in 1960 and compare that to something Mitt Romney said yesterday. Stay with us.
People tend to say, well, if we leave, there's going to be chaos. I don't believe that. 78% of the Iraqis say that's not going to happen. 78% of the Iraqis say it'll be, we're the ones that are causing this. And Al-Qaeda is going to be, Al-Qaeda is going to disappear.
Congressman Jack Murtha, as he gets ready to push legislation that would, in effect, try to get the United States out of Iraq without calling it that. And we're talking, well, we'll talk about some of the details of that, too, as we continue with Professor Julian Zelizer. He's a congressional historian at Boston University. He has a March article in the American Prospect magazine on how Congress helped end the Vietnam War. And a presidential historian, Douglas Brinkley from Tulane University. He has a new book about Gerald Ford. So we have a congressional historian and a presidential historian as we are at a point of potential constitutional crisis with Congress about to try to manage the Iraq war in some new and different ways, or so it appears. But let's take another phone call. Phil in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling because it seems to me that the vote in the House and the one that was just missed by four votes in the Senate really amounts to the equivalent of a no-confidence vote. We don't have a parliamentary system of government, but it seems to me that what Congress is saying, certainly the House is saying, what some of the Senate are trying to say, is intelligence. Pre-war intelligence was at best hyped and probably lies. There wasn't going to be a mushroom cloud. There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no yellow cake uranium. And now Congress, after all of this, and the people, after all this, no longer have confidence in the president. And so the effort is really to cast a no-confidence vote, even though that's not in our Constitution.
Phil, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. Professor Zelizer, do you interpret it that way?
To a certain extent, I think it's a bit of a setup vote in that, the Congress is trying to think not just in the next few weeks what it's going to do, but how is it going to voice and express its opposition in the next year, year and a half. And I think it was important, and it is still important, for Congress to get on record that a majority, at least, of the institution is against both the reasons for the war, but I think even more what we're hearing is the implementation of the war, how the battle is being handled, what's being done. I think many Democrats sense that that's where the administration is most vulnerable, that after going in there, they didn't handle it right. And I think this is an attempt to create the foundation for more aggressive efforts to restrict the president, either the authorization issue we were talking about, whether they go after funding. It's unclear whether they'll take that step, but I think many Democrats and Republicans like Hagel feel that the first step is to get this on record, to get Democrats saying no confidence in what the administration was doing, and they want as many Republicans in that vote as possible. I don't think they were as successful as they hoped because they want to avoid this being just a partisan attack on the administration. They want it to be bipartisan, like much of the opposition ultimately was in Vietnam.
Well, when Congressman Murtha talks about what he's going to do, and he was speaking in general terms in the clip we played, but when he speaks in specific terms, he's talking about things like making sure that the funding that they authorize for the troops is spent to sufficiently train them to fight in Iraq, and that they haven't been sufficiently trained to date, to make sure that they have sufficient equipment in Iraq and say that they haven't been given sufficient equipment to date. So it's an interesting twist on cutting off funding for quantity, that is, for the numbers of troops in the so-called troop surge, by requiring funding for quality.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's trying to do and what Pelosi, who supported this strategy, has tried to do is they don't want to make this a debate over do we fund the troops or do we support the troops, which is the question that always arises when funding of a war is being debated, toward the Democrats saying, well, let us support the troops financially. Let's give them everything they need. And I think the effort politically is to force the administration to say no, that we don't want to give that funding to protect the troops, to make sure they can actually accomplish the mission. So I think it's a circular attempt to get right to this funding issue without making themselves susceptible in 2008 to this charge that they cut funding and endanger troops in the field. It's
right.
It's a tough, I think, objective, but I think it was actually it's a smart rhetorical way and to do this.
It's pretty transparent, though. I guess there's a risk in either, you know, in either direction if they just straightforwardly cut off funds for the troop surge or to try to stop the troop surge, because then the president wouldn't have enough total funding. Then they risk, as you say, getting slapped with not supporting the troops. On the other hand, it's clear what they're doing. They're trying to stop the president from sending in these 21,500 additional Americans by requiring better training and better arming of them.
And they're trying to force the issue on the table, again, of implementation. Were we really capable, or are we capable of achieving the kind of war we are now in? I think part of what Murtha is saying is we are not. We don't have the kind of army right now that could handle this kind of a civil war conflagration while we're dealing with the war on terrorism and other threats around the world. And I think he's trying to raise that point as much as get to a way to cut funding. And that's the Democrats' objective. Again, though, they're still going to be susceptible to the very basic gut-level charge that you're cutting funding in the middle of war.
Hillary in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Hillary.
Hello. I understand the importance of discussing the war going forward and what's to be done, but I'm wondering whether the Newt Gingrich comment about the Barbary Coast pirates is really a parallel for what's going on. If we were attacked, we were being attacked by the pirates. So why would the president need Congress's authorization to defend the country? In the case of Iraq, we were not attacked. It was preemptive. So how is that quote really parallel to this situation?
Interesting question. And for those of you who didn't hear it, about 20 minutes ago, we played a clip of Newt Gingrich from Fox News Sunday yesterday saying, quote, Jefferson sent the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Navy to Tripoli, attacking Barbary pirates who had been capturing Americans without notifying Congress. So, Professor Zelizer?
I think what the administration would say in response to that call is that we are in a new age when we have to contain or deal with potential threats before they emerge. So in a very complex sense, that we were on the verge of being attacked by Iraq. And so there is a comparison there. I mean, that's the basic argument of preemptive war, of how the administration has framed the war on terrorism. If you support that argument, I think that's the response. There is a parallel. We're not in an era anymore when we can afford to be attacked. This isn't just a pirate threat. The argument is this is a threat of weapons of mass destruction of great and terrible consequence. And so I think that's how Gingrich would make the comparison. Again, I think many people would disagree with that, but that goes back to the root argument that has been made since 2001 and since 2003 in terms of how do we handle the threat we face in the post-9/11 world.
Here's an email that says simply, why is it a crisis instead of just a problem? And so that goes to the term constitutional crisis, or I've been saying potential constitutional crisis. Getting that from others in the media and a few in Congress who say over the next few months, as Congress tries to implement the kinds of things we've been talking about, modifying the 2002 Iraq War authorization or managing how the money has to be spent on the troops, a la Congressman Murtha, that this may become a constitutional crisis. This listener suggests that language may be overblown. Professor Zelizer, as a history of Congress, as a historian of Congress, what do you think?
It can become a crisis. We're still in that potential phase, and I think right now it is a problem. It's not a crisis. A crisis would emerge if Congress clearly and defiantly sends a no to the administration, not just in a no-confidence vote, but says you cannot spend the money on this kind of operation, or you cannot spend the money unless you do X, Y, and Z. And if the president then says, well, I will not follow the will of Congress, and says constitutionally I don't have to follow the will of Congress, that's when you enter into a crisis. That gets us back to the early 70s, the War Powers Act, when Nixon in some ways pushed the limits of presidential power beyond what Democrats were willing to accept. And so I think we are still in the problem phase. I agree 100%, but it's not that far away from a crisis if Congress decides to act. Again, they might not, but if they do, if the funding in the next couple of months becomes an area where Congress tries to put some bite behind the opposition and the president continues the pattern we've seen now since 2001 of aggressive executive power, then we could enter a real true crisis.
Sally in Soho, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I think that what Newt Gingrich was referring to is that Iran is like the Barbary pirates, and that the president doesn't need to have any authority because he can just go get them because they're killing our troops.
Because they're sending arms, at least, to Iraqis killing our troops. And Sally may be right. What about Iran? This is another flashpoint that some people say could become a constitutional crisis. You have Joe Biden, among others, saying that they're going to introduce resolutions to require the president to come back to Congress for authorization should he ever consider going even 1 mile into Iran to try to get whatever those weapon supply chains are.
Look, if that Gingrich argument, you know, would hold, I think the administration would have a lot of leeway to attack many nation states. There's been evidence, you know, from other areas that support to the insurgents is not just from within Iraq, but from without. But certainly with Iran, you would have a case where that Gingrich argument could be applied. But I just don't think at this point in the war, at this point in U.S. history, there's going to be a lot of congressional tolerance for trying to extend the troops, extend the mission beyond where we are now. It's not really sustainable. I mean, you're hearing that from Republicans, Democrats, even members of the administration. So to open up a front in Iran right now and use this argument going back to Jefferson, I think wouldn't just be dangerous constitutionally, but it would be very dangerous politically, not just for the administration, but equally important, and maybe more important in terms of politics, for Republicans who are thinking of 2008, who are thinking, how are voters going to react come the next election, both presidential candidates and congressmen and congresswomen. I think that would be a tough, tough sell on Capitol Hill.
We have a few minutes left with Julian Zelizer, congressional historian at Boston University. He has an article in the March issue of the American Prospect magazine on how Congress helped end the Vietnam War. We had presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, but his line seems to have dropped off in the New Orleans airport. He wasn't supposed to be with us from the airport, but because his flight got delayed, as many people's have around the country, he wound up at the airport at this time that the program was scheduled, and we don't seem to be able to get him back on his cell phone. So we'll finish up with Professor Zelizer, and here's an email that says, why is impeachment totally off the table? There was an op-ed in the Times a couple of weeks ago wondering why Bush hasn't been investigated or impeached because of the NSA wiretapping scandal. It shouldn't be considered wacky to impeach President Bush if he's committed crimes, should it? And in fact, I don't know, Professor Zelizer, if you watched Fox News Sunday yesterday, but it was almost a smoking gun moment with respect to misleading the American people on any connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda before the war. They replayed a clip of Douglas Feith from the Pentagon Special Intelligence Office from before the war, who said on Fox News Sunday last week, defending his actions, he said, we never claimed that there was an operational relationship between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. And Chris Wallace showed a quote from the conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, in which Feith was quoted saying exactly that at the time. There is an operational relationship, he used those words, between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. And he gave, you know, some examples in generalities of the ways he thought in which they were cooperating in an operational relationship. And then after that, as Chris Wallace reminded us, Dick Cheney, the vice president, cited that article in the Weekly Standard with the Feith quote as the best single source of evidence on, you know, assessing the Al-Qaeda-Saddam relationship. Now it's come out in this recent report that, you know, that Feith is suspected of purposely misleading the country around that, although they said he did nothing illegal. But since that leads at least back to the vice president, is impeachment completely off the table?
It seems that it's off the table politically at this point. You don't hear a lot of Democrats talking about it. I think many Democrats still remain scared of replicating what Republicans did in the late 1990s, meaning that they waste or lose their political capital that they've gained in Congress on an impeachment that turns out ultimately to be not popular, to be what the public does not want. And I think many Democrats are still skittish about doing that. That said, I do think there are serious questions and issues that have been raised. The one about the potential manipulation and promotion of evidence before the war is a serious issue. It's part of what the Scooter Libby trial was really about, even though it ended up focusing on obstruction of justice. And Feith is one example, and the, you know, Joseph Wilson article and the response by the vice president. We don't know as much about the president in terms of trying to rebut critics and counter information. It's certainly an area I'm sure many Democrats at least wonder, you know, should we go toward an impeachment? That said, though, I don't think there's the political will at this point. And I don't think many Democrats feel they need to do it. I think they feel they have a lot of strength right now, a lot of momentum, and that if they do that, there's that potential to get the public against them. The public ultimately likes to solve things usually in elections rather than in Congress or through the courts with any kind of impeachment or legal proceedings.
Let me ask you one thing about presidential politics,
yep,
the 2008 race. This was going to be for Professor Brinkley, but I think you can handle it. Mitt Romney was on ABC this week with George Stephanopoulos, and he was asked about possibly being the first Mormon president and the relatively high resistance to that that has showed up in some polls. Stephanopoulos played a clip of John F. Kennedy from his 1960 campaign when the issue was his Catholicism, and then he asked Romney about it. So listen to how differently Romney positions himself than the way Kennedy did at the time. The first voice we will hear is JFK's.
When no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote. When no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference.
Is that what you believe?
Well, we have a separation of church and state in this country, and we should, and it served us well. I don't believe, for instance, we should take "under God" out of the Pledge of Allegiance. I don't think we should take "in God we trust" off of our coins. There's a point at which we take something which is a good principle to an extreme.
How about funding faith-based institutions?
Well, we don't fund faith-based institutions other than when they're performing a non-faith role. So right now we have faith-based initiatives in our state. Ann happens to lead that effort. And some of the faith-based institutions, particularly in the inner city, are doing a lot better job helping the poor, helping kids, helping families get on their feet than some government social service agencies. And so helping them in their secular role is, of course, fine.
So, Professor Zelizer, I'm struck in that exchange by how Romney is kind of the opposite of JFK in those clips. JFK is promising separation of church and state. Romney is talking about faith-based initiatives and ensuring that God remain in the pledge and on our currency. What do you make of the difference? And the way he's positioning himself?
Well, it's the dilemma of the context that Romney finds himself in. JFK was playing to a Democratic Party, to a general population that was becoming more secular, and that was moving farther and farther away from mixing religion and politics. And so when he made that appeal, there was more strength for him to do well in the elections. Romney, I think in the general elections, I don't think this issue of Mormonism is going to be as great as some say, if he makes it that far.
But you know what they're looking at is, and and I know you've seen these, very small opposition to the idea of Barack Obama as a part black candidate, very little opposition to the idea of Hillary Clinton as a woman, regardless of what anybody thinks of them as individuals, and yet this like 20% reluctance to vote for somebody who's a Mormon.
Yeah, I do think, though, he can overcome that in a general election by just being out there explaining, you know, what his religion is and what he's about. But I think he's in a bind with the primaries because, you know, he is in a party that has made religion front and center in the last 10 years. And, you know, he's trying to appeal to evangelical Christians who believe this should be a public matter. I mean, that's part of why he's talking about the faith-based initiative.
And funny enough, as I understand it, this double-digit resistance to voting for a Mormon doesn't come from secular America. It actually comes more from Christian evangelicals.
That's his biggest area of danger, but that's who he has to win over. And he has a problem. He is going to have to persuade them ultimately, A, not to care about Mormonism, which I think is going to be difficult from the polls we're seeing, and B, that his potential to win is greater than the anxieties they fear about him being a Mormon. But he can't escape his own party at this moment in history. He's not playing to the Democrats of 1960. He's playing to the Republicans of 2007, and they care about religion.
Do you understand any of the content of the reluctance of evangelical Christians to vote for a Mormon Christian? What's the difference? You know, because to secular New York and secular Boston, they see it as two conservative Christian religions.
I can't claim to know kind of what's driving the evangelical fears, but I think there's a certain irony, obviously, just observing it from anywhere in the country, that a part of the party that has made this claim that religion should be so central should be so reluctant to have it if it's, you know, one kind of religion over the other. So I think that's where many people would see this.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history at Boston University. He has an article in the March American Prospect Liberal Magazine on how Congress helped end the Vietnam War. His latest book is called The American Congress. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In a minute, we're actually going to play more from that George Stephanopoulos-Mitt Romney interview that's very revealing, and take your reactions at 212-433-WNYC.